I know that we're all very familiar with this gospel passage of the road to Emmaus, and it does, of course, connect for us our Lord's insistence, his desire that the Eucharist continue to be celebrated in the church well past the time of the Last Supper, making the Last Supper not a one-and-done deal, but something that our Lord meant for real. Do this in memory of me. Take this, all of you, and eat it. And for as long as you recall the memory of my death, I am with you until the end of time. So what our Lord is doing here, if you notice, is he's establishing for our disciples in the story today, Cleopas and this other gentleman, the pattern for how we worship in the church. You notice that every Mass is constructed with two parts, the liturgy of the Word and the liturgy of the Eucharist. And our blessed Lord does both things on the road to Emmaus. The first part of the story is he's explaining the scriptures to them, like the liturgy of the Word. He gets to the inn, and he has this breaking of bread in their midst, liturgy of the Eucharist. You can already see a pattern already being developed here. And our Lord, of course, allows these disciples to remain somewhat in the dark about who he is. And they have an inkling of who this Jesus of Nazarene should have been. And obviously they knew about the Last Supper, without that they would not have been able to recognize him in the breaking of the bread. They had some basis for knowing. The apostles at this time must have told Cleopas and this man, the night before he died, before he was given over by Judas, he celebrated the Passover in the upper room, and he did something very strange. He said, "Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body, and this is my blood." You can almost imagine that for the apostles, as they were waiting in the upper room to see what would happen next, perhaps they too were already celebrating the Eucharist, very likely, that they too already were perpetuating the mystery of the Lord. In any case, these men are not quite sure what to make of what's happened. They're dejected, they're despondent, and our Lord performs for them the first liturgy of the Word and perhaps arguably the first Christian Bible study, explaining to them on the road to Emmaus everything from Moses all the way up to his own time and how all the prophecies referred to him. And if you notice that the reaction of these two disciples is very different. At first we meet them and they're dejected, despondent, and they're sad. But once they recognize our Lord in the breaking of the bread after the meal, they are immediately enlivened and emboldened to go back to Jerusalem. And this would have been a rather reckless thing to do in a certain perspective. From a very human perspective, one of the reasons why they were pulling over in Emmaus at dusk was to get off the road at dusk because the roads were very dangerous at night. I mean, we all know the experience, perhaps, if we've lived in certain parts of the world or in certain cities. You know, you don't walk through certain neighborhoods alone at night because something bad might happen to you. Well, that was pretty much the overall reality of living outside city walls for the most part. Thieves and bandits could harm you. So on a natural level, they're thinking, get off the road, we'll have a meal here, spend the night at the inn, continue on the next day. If they were operating after having recognized our Lord in the breaking of the bread, then it would have stopped there. They would have said, okay, good, we see him, we'll head back to Jerusalem in the morning. Not at all. The moment they know they have been with the Lord, they put aside any of their natural instincts and they proceed back to Jerusalem to confirm with the 11 that in fact this, what they perhaps perceived at first to be a tale told by the women, was in fact very much true. He is alive. He is not dead. He has been resurrected. Now, to be sure, you know, our Lord reveals himself in this very, very powerful way in the breaking of the bread. And what I want to share with you for a moment this morning is what this really means for us and what it meant for these two disciples And there's an enemy of this line that is really the crux of the entire passage. Were not our hearts burning within us while he spoke to us on the way and opened the scriptures to us? Were not our hearts burning within us? I want to talk a little bit about lukewarmness, spiritual boredom. We call it in Latin acedia, the great enemy of the soul in regards to that which kills the flame of faith alive in someone's heart. But before that, perhaps a personal story that can help illuminate a little bit better, I hope, our understanding of recognizing him in the breaking of the bread, in the Eucharist. When I was in college, my college chaplaincy, to be fair, was mediocre at best. And that's an indictment on the university I attended. This chaplaincy is completely separate from it. It's much better now, happily, and the Dominicans who are there now are doing a tremendously good job. I can't believe at times when I still go back to my old college chapel to see the changes that have been made for the good. But architecturally, I was in a place and time where the tabernacle was actually, let's say we were in this church, the tabernacle is where the cry room is. And the sanctuary is pretty bare, just a chair for the priest and maybe a server and a pretty non-impressive altar, just a table. It was just really nothing. And it's a shame, you know, because it's a time in life when, you know, you really should be forming young minds and hearts. I mean, these are the future Catholics, you know, the church and, you know, people who are being educated at a major university. And so over time, as I reflect back on it now, I realized that I began to lose recognition of the real presence, that our Lord was substantially and really present. Now, I didn't have a theological qualm with the church. I didn't, although I wasn't arguing intellectually, that was just, it was just bread and wine after the consecration. I wasn't that sophisticated enough. It was just merely, when you go to church and you don't genuflect and you don't kneel for the consecration, you know, just after over time, you just kind of, you lose it. You know, you lose the sense that our Lord is really and substantially present. And that was the way I worshiped for 4 years of my life. I never knelt during the consecration, ever. And, you know, these were all obviously bad things. They were not meant to be like that, but that was the way it was. And, you know, I was a regular college student, didn't really question much. I figured the priests knew what they were doing, and I'll just do what they do. And so, after college, I went back to Northern Virginia, and I was living in my home parish boundary, and I was coaching a junior high CYO basketball team, and I used to get there pretty early. And this is the day before texting and smartphones. I didn't really have much to do but read. But every so often I'd look up reading in my car and I'd look across the street and I'd see these people shuffling in and out of the perpetual adoration chapel in my parish. Now this is a very, very bold venture, perpetual adoration chapel. It means that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at least two parishioners are assigned to keep watch of our Lord, and they adore our Lord exposed in the monstrance in the Blessed Sacrament. The nearest one here, for example, would be up the highway at Our Lady of Angels in Woodbridge. They have a chapel there, an old chapel, which is now converted into their perpetual adoration chapel. And it's, you know, a very beautiful witness. Well, I would go in there before practice. My team was pretty good, so we practiced 3 or 4 times a week, and they were very intense, I should say, and very committed. So I used to go and practice with them 4 times a week, and 4 days of the week, I would go into this perpetual adoration chapel in the parish where I had grown up, and about 5 or 6 times after I went in, one day, wham, hit me between the eyes. Oh my goodness gracious, that is Jesus. Oh my heavens. Oh my goodness, that is God. Simply, ready for the first time in my life since my first communion, I recognized him in the breaking of the bread. And disciples, you know, there's an interesting journey with them on the road to Emmaus. At first, they're explaining to Jesus whom they expected the Jesus of Nazarene to be. Ironically, of course, they're talking to the very Jesus of Nazareth they're expecting that, you know, this man should have known about. And it's an intellectual discussion. But then the heart burns with love when they recognize him in the breaking of the bread. So in this moment, in this perpetual adoration chapel, an intellectual grasp in the mind suddenly met a movement in the heart. And the distance between head and heart were almost closed. What I believed is what is whom I loved. And whom I love is what in whom I believed. See, that integration, right? But that can easily get killed off if you're not careful, which I'll talk about in a second. So over time, over the course of 3 years, I would go to adoration every day. Some doesn't matter if it was practice or not, I just go. And I would just kneel and just relish being in the presence of the Lord. I didn't really say much, I didn't know what to say. Incidentally, at the time, I had to start making some decisions about careers. I was in management consulting, and I had to make a decision whether or not to go to law school or get an MBA, etc., all those things. And during that time with our Lord, it just became very clear after a while that maybe he was calling me to spend all my time, if you will, in here. And little by little, then I started going to Mass every day, and that was the killer. That's what hooked me in. And I thought to myself, you know, I could receive him every day, why don't I? And, I mean, very slowly, just things changed, and I became a priest. I didn't ever intend going into an adoration chapel to become a priest. I never thought that would happen. And I was just, you know, just dumbfounded by, my goodness, Jesus has been here all this time, and I rarely come by to say hi. And that recognition of our Lord in the breaking of the bread is life-changing. In fact, I noticed as my years of seminary went on years later, that as I would meet new men coming to the seminary, I always said, you know, I've seen this guy somewhere before. You know where I saw him? Same chapel. Doing the same thing. Physicians, lawyers, accountants, engineers, all professionals. We were all professionals, for the most part. We all had careers, military men, etc., officers. And then recognizing me in the breaking of the bread is what happened for all of us. Now, I'm not trying to suggest here that, you know, everyone here is called to the priesthood and religious life. I know some of you are, and you're here, and you know that. I mean, those who are called, fine. But it is to say, though, that we must ask on a day when the church presents us with this gospel, how much time do I set aside to recognize him in the breaking of the bread? Would I come here and make a visit? I mean, the church is open every night till 9. Would I come here to make a visit just to spend a few minutes? I mean, and you don't have to say anything. You know, I think sometimes people get discouraged because they don't hear anything, or they don't know what to say, or they don't know what to do. I think the best way to explain it is sort of, when you go and hang out with an old friend, an old buddy of yours, or, you know, an old girlfriend, sometimes you don't have to say anything. It's just fun to be together. You can go driving for miles in the car and not really feel like you need to say anything. It's just good to be together. Like husband and wife in a way, you know. Just, you know, you've been married so many years, and what are you going to say, you know? I mean, everything's been said, right? Especially for the men. But you just want to be together. You know, you want to be with the person you love, right? And that, in a way, that's how adoration can be a reality for your life, that we're really a parish of people who really adore our Lord. And, you know, I'm so happy that I've been assigned in parishes for the most part, some exceptions, unfortunately, where the tabernacle is in the middle, where our Lord is King, where He is adored, where He is number one, where the priest doesn't sit like in a throne up there, that He's really in charge. He's the one who runs the parish. Father and I are just caretakers. And so, if we're unwilling to do that, then one of the problems that we're going to run into is this lukewarmness. It's a shady, a spiritual boredom. It's a lack of interest in things of God or God Himself. And so often do I hear parents complain to me, you know, Father, I don't know what to say to my teenage son or daughter. They come to Mass every Sunday, but begrudgingly, and they always leave saying, you know, Father, Mass is boring. And I said, well, do they know what happens at Mass? And they say, I don't know. And I said, well, I bet you they don't. Because if they did, they wouldn't be bored. I mean, my hands still tremble when I say the words of institution. I hope that never stops. My hands still shake when I say, this is my body and this is my blood. Because, as our second graders yesterday who made their first communion can tell you, what's happening on the altar is a dual miracle. The first miracle is that an ordained priest is changing ordinary bread and wine into the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus Christ. That in and of itself is already a miracle. The most powerful miracle happening at every moment of the day on earth. The second miracle is that even though the substance of the bread and wine change into the body and blood, soul and divinity of our Lord, the appearances still remain, which is very unusual. I explained to the second graders, I said, you know, if you take a match lit to a piece of paper and light it, in 5 seconds you'll have ashes. You don't say burnt paper, you say it's something different now, Father. It's ashes. Why? Because it looks like it. And the only way I know it's something different is because it looks different. In the Eucharist, it's the reverse. A substantial change occurs, yet the appearances remain the same. That's a dual miracle. This is the most powerful thing happening in the world at every moment. But if we're not engaged in that reality, and almost harken back to that time when I first knelt down in a perpetual adoration chapel and said, bam! Oh my goodness gracious, that's God. Then we begin to lose over time, not usually gradually, and it's not even intentional. It's just sort of like just this weakness, this atrophy of a spiritual muscle that is not used, and we no longer recognize Him. If we don't open the Word regularly to be nourished by the Word, if we don't perform voluntary acts of mortification, small acts of self-denial, like, for example, just simply, not going to watch TV today. Not going to listen to the radio in the car. Not going to put ketchup on my fries. Not going to have fries. No ice in the drink. Nothing major. Just small voluntary mortifications that say, in order for the soul to master the body, the soul has to be in the habit of telling the body no. Not because the body is bad, but because the soul is bad. Both are good. But we all know, because of original sin, when you leave the body to its own devices, it will do things the soul knows it's wrong. Right? And I don't even mean morally wrong. You can just be bad for your health. You have to exercise willpower in order to remain disciplined, in order to recognize Him in the breaking of the bread. It requires faith. It is a challenge. Now, to conclude, look how different these men were once they knew with whom they were with. Amazing. And I would be very, very, I'd venture a guess that probably these men, more than likely, if they didn't die as martyrs, they preached the faith like the apostles to the ends of the earth, because they wanted others, too, to recognize Him in the breaking of the bread. You know, as a priest, I don't say Mass for me. I say Mass for you. If it were just for me, I could say Mass in my room. And I can. And when I've been sick, I have. But because it's life-changing to recognize him in the breaking of the bread, I would willingly lay down my life so that you might also as well. And so on this Mother's Day, as we give thanks to our mothers, who in perhaps most, if not all cases, taught us the faith first and gave us that faith through baptism and helped nurture it, let us always be appreciative and mindful of what our Lord has done for us here, and to become people of greater adoration, persons nourished on a regular basis with the Word, and persons also of mortified life that are able to let the soul lead the body to the pastures of everlasting life with our Lord. Well, we will no longer see him under the appearances of bread and wine, but we will see him as he is in all his resurrected glory. O Mary, conceived without sin,